Hello, podcasters, and welcome once again to this series of podcasts brought to you in association with Kilkenny Library Services and the Government's Decade of Centenaries Fund through Kilkenny County Council. My name is Owen Swinton Welch, and in these podcasts, we explore different aspects of Kilkenny's revolutionary era history. Now, in the last podcast, we examined the first 2 months or so of the Civil War in Kilkenny. In many ways, it was a traditional war. What I mean by that is that the two sides battled each other across a front line, as we saw in the fighting in Waterford and Carrick-on-Shore. However, by the end of August 1922, and for the rest of the Civil War really, things reverted to a guerrilla war, the type of fighting we saw during the War of Independence. Now, this type of combat became more of a necessity, more than a choice, for the anti-treaty side. When you have less resources and less weapons than your adversary, it's one of the only ways of having the upper hand or having the advantage. Surprise them, attack, and then retreat. It's the reason why it was used by the IRA against the much superior Crown forces in the previous conflict. But firstly, just to put ourselves in the position of our ancestors back in August 1922 in Kilkenny, what would they have been reading in the newspapers and what would they be thinking? Well, it actually really looked like the Civil War was coming to an end after 6 weeks of fighting by the end of August 22. The anti-treaty forces had been removed from all the main urban centres that they held. So it might have seemed to those not directly involved that the anti-treaty side had nowhere to go, only to the countryside, and it would all be over pretty soon. Indeed, this is a theme of wars generally around the world, where people often think they're going to be short conflicts when they often turn out to be much longer than anticipated. Liam Lynch, the leader of the anti-treaty forces, then gave orders for all the anti-treaty units around Ireland, including Kilkenny, to organise flying columns. But even this was seen as the last throw of the dice. But as we witnessed during the War of Independence, flying columns, and they're also called ASUs or Active Service Units, are very difficult to defeat once they keep moving around. And really, you only needed a handful of fighters to be called a column, and they could easily attack a lorry load of Free State soldiers. The anti-treaty forces in Kilkenny and beyond, although not flush with guns, actually had more weapons and ammo during the Civil War than they ever had during the War of Independence. Some of these guns had been purchased during the truce period before the IRA splitting. In addition, many weapons, including machine guns, as we heard before in the previous podcast, had been stolen from the Black and Tans, the British soldiers and the RSE before they were disbanded in the spring of 1922. Also, Free State barracks were raided during the summer of 22, which increased the anti-treaty armoury as Free State forces were being supplied with a steady supply of weapons from Britain. In other words, to surmise, there was a lot more guns going around. But before we move into examining the autumn of 1922, we will take a look at the reaction to Arthur Griffith's and Michael Collins' death in Kilkenny. Firstly, the president of Dáil Éireann, that's Arthur Griffith, died at the age of 51 from a cerebral hemorrhage, that's on his death cert, or a stroke probably, just 9 months after he had returned from negotiating the treaty. The mayor of Kilkenny, Peter de Lucri, said that they had been personal friends for a number of years, their friendship having been cemented while they were together for quite a long period in British prisons, and this was after the German plot arrests of March 1918. Griffith had actually also made a visit to Kilkenny during the 1917 by-election and toured around the city. Mayor de Lucri attended the funeral in the Pro-Cathedral in Dublin, along with Thomas Tracy, former OC of the Kilkenny IRA Brigade during the War of Independence. Now, as the funeral was taking place in Dublin, that was 1 to 3 o'clock on Wednesday the 16th of August 1922, all the businesses in Kilkenny City and County closed as a mark of respect. Less than a week after Griffith's funeral, Michael Collins, the Commander-in-Chief and Chairman of the Provisional Government, was killed. The three Kilkenny newspapers all contained photographs and biographies of the deceased leader, along with a detailed synopsis of his final hours in Cork. Even the Kilkenny Moderator, which had not always approved of Michael Collins's warfare message during the War of Independence, had black borders around the print columns to symbolise mourning. Although he didn't have a direct connection with Kilkenny as such, he had passed through and visited Lady Desart, someone's previously. Also, Collins's main man, so to speak, during the War of Independence in terms of the IRA Intelligence Department was Liam Tobin, who was a former student of Kilkenny CBS. He had done much of the donkey work in the very successful intelligence department during that conflict. At the exact time Michael Collins's funeral was taking place in Dublin, that's on Monday afternoon, the 28th of August, 1922, a high mass was celebrated in St Mary's Cathedral in Kilkenny City for the repose of his soul, along with that of Arthur Griffiths. The cathedral was full to capacity, and there were many hundreds outside who were unable to gain admittance. So we're talking thousands in and beyond the cathedral walls. There were 38 priests or religious brothers in attendance at the ceremony. Commandant Prout led a detachment of Free State soldiers to the service from Kilkenny military barracks. Afterwards, there was a military procession through the city, led by the army band, who played funeral-type music, it was reported. Upon reaching the parade, the Free State soldiers fired three volleys of shots into the air in honor of their dead chief, and the last post was then sounded by the buglers. All businesses in Kilkenny shut for the entire day. Actually, earlier in the day, about 500 people, including most of the county councillors, left by train on the morning of the funeral in order to view the funeral ceremony in Dublin, like many hundreds of thousands of people. However, they had just left Kilkenny when they had to turn back. This was because the anti-treaty IRA had dug up the tracks just outside the city. At about 4 a.m. that morning, there had been sporadic sniping directed towards the military barracks, which was used as a distraction as the anti-treaty forces were dismantling the tracks. Many of those who were left stranded in Kilkenny because of the lack of train services had to make do with the mass in St Mary's Cathedral. Now, Peter Dolucri and Councillor Thomas Butler did manage to make it to Collins' funeral in the Pro Cathedral in Dublin, as they had travelled up the evening beforehand. In Thomastown and Castlecomer and Callan, all the local businesses also closed during the hours the funeral was taking place in Dublin, while in addition, a novena, that's 9 days of masses, took place in the diocese for the repose of the souls of President Griffiths and General Michael Collins. Now, to get back to the military side of things of the Civil War in Kilkenny, from the autumn of 22, the anti-treaty IRA within the county were able to survive in the rural areas where there was little presence of the Free State Army, except in some villages and when the latter passed through on patrols. As the Civil War progressed, the anti-treaty IRA units within the county became more and more isolated, which meant they act mostly on their own initiative when planning attacks or moving around. In addition, the Kilkenny IRA Brigade, that used to encompass the entire county was split in half during the Civil War. So the anti-treaty forces operated separately in a Kilkenny North Brigade and a Kilkenny South Brigade. This made sense in terms of logistics, as for example, the anti-treaty IRA leaders couldn't be travelling the length and breadth of the county for meetings with the other leaders. The area between Callan and Mountcoin, including Mundavasse and the whole southwest corner of the county, saw the most action in the Southern Brigade. The Urlingford and Paulstown areas saw much activity at the other end of the county. Now, the number of anti-treaty ASUs, or flying columns, operating in Kilkenny fluctuated throughout the Civil War. Generally, however, there were five main columns in operation in the county. These ASUs linked up and subdivided on occasion, while personnel often changed depending on arrests and so forth. In addition, the ASUs, or the flying columns, were not continuously active as combatants needed periods of rest, etc. Ned Elward, the South Kilkenny Anti-Treaty IRA Brigade leader, was in command of an ASU which was mainly located in the west of the county, although his column continuously crisscrossed the Kilkenny-Tipperary border. For large parts of the Civil War, Elward and his West Kilkenny ASU combined with Dinny Lacy's 2nd Division Flying Column to form one super column. During the Civil War, Elward's column travelled as far south as Piltown and as far north as Johnstown. Elward was often assisted by Martin Mulhall's 1st Kilkenny ASU, which was made up of men mostly from in and around the Kilkenny City area. This ASU moved east and west across the county, linking up with the other ASUs as opportunities arose. There was a third flying column in the south of the county, encompassing the areas of Mountcoin, Piltown, Kilmacow, Huggins Town, and Mullinavass. It had between 15 and 20 men at any one time. For the majority of the period, this South Kilkenny ASU was under the command of Richard Dick Brennan from Lochinure Munkine. Another ASU was based in the east of the county and covered a large area, including Castlecomer, Paulstown, Goran, Thomastown, and Gregnamana. It sometimes passed over the border into County Carlow as well. It was commanded by Martin Medler of Paulstown. Lastly, a large column of between 30 and 45 men under the command of Martin Bates was active in the 6th Battalion area. So that was the whole area southeast of the county from Greig down to Glenmore. In September 1922 as well, the anti-treaty IRA were able to issue proclamations which were posted up in villages. One proclamation written by Thomas Bellew, operations commander of the Kilkenny anti-treaty IRA, said the following, quote, "From the 7th day of September 1922, no motor-driven vehicle will be allowed to travel through the area of the Kilkenny Brigade. Any person disobeying the above order shall incur the risk of being fired upon. Doctors attending to professional duties may use motor cars provided that the large red cross is displayed." End quote. Motor cars and lorries, as you can imagine, were the main method of transport for the Free State Army, hence the proclamation. In a similar way, notices were placed up around Callan, warning civilians not to give information or speak too freely, as it was written, about the location of the anti-treaty forces in the area. It should be noted that the Free State Army were in a much better position than their adversaries in one specific way. When they captured a member of the anti-treaty IRA or a suspected member, they arrested and interned them, usually without any trial. The prisoners were generally sent to Kilkenny or Waterford jails, with many later being transferred to camps in the Curragh. Throughout September and October 1922, large roundups occurred. Obviously, the anti-treaty IRA did not have the same advantage or luxury of capturing Free State soldiers and holding them for indefinite periods. Now, the Free State Army were not blind to the anti-treaty columns roaming around the countryside. They received many reports about the whereabouts of flying columns, but often chose not to engage unless it was strategically important and they had ample backup. A Free State intelligence officer in Carrickon Shore had a very novel way of keeping tabs on an anti-treaty ASU column that was passing through nearby Piltown and Hoggenstown. He hired a scout, who was a boy or at least a young teenager, to follow the anti-treaty men and report back. In that way, the Free State Army in the area at least knew the position of the constantly moving column, while the young lad, of course, would not arouse suspicion. IRA and Free State soldiers at that were used to young people coming up to them and asking to see their guns, etc. The Free State Intelligence Network were also aware of the on-foot communication network provided by the women of Cumann na Mban. A report from the Munkine Free State Garrison described in detail how the anti-treaty IRA lines of communication stayed opened in the southwest of Kilkenny, which implies that the South Kilkenny Brigade leader Ned Elward was in regular communication with his comrades in the south of the county. It also revealed how a dispatch could be transmitted a distance of over 30 kilometres in a very relative short space of time by utilising a chain of couriers. So here's the Free State memo. Quote, "Dispatches are carried every day by a girl from Kiltrassy near Newmarket, travelling by cycle by Jamestown to Powers of Brainer and Piltown. From Powers, another girl goes to Donovan's of Dowling. From Donovan's to Brennan's of Knockanure near Kilnaspic Church of Munkine. Then a middle-aged man named Brennan then walks through Silverspring Grange to Munkine." End quote. So we can see from that their intelligence was pretty good. Now, there were signs in September 22 in Kilkenny City, at least anyway, that civil life was beginning to return to something regarding normality. On Wednesday the 27th of September, the first ever batch of Civic Guard, later of course known as An Garda Síochána, took up their posts in Kilkenny City, and it was described by a local journalist as such, quote, "On Wednesday evening, 22 members of the Civic Guard, including three sergeants, in command of Superintendent Lynch, arrived in Kilkenny City and marched to the old RIC police barracks in Parliament Street," that's no longer there. "The Civic Guard is purely a civil force. Its members carry no firearms. Their duty is to protect the citizens." End quote. And Ireland is actually one of the rare examples in the Western world where the police still don't carry firearms generally. Other areas of Kilkenny received their new Garda recruits the following month, which included Callan, Thomastown, Castlecomer and Greignamana. Castlecomer received its detachment on the 20th of October, Callan was on the 28th of October and Thomastown was on the 29th of October 1922, so big changes of force everywhere. But it must be said also that much disruption to general life was still caused in the autumn of 1922. For example, the Piltown or the Iverk Agricultural Show was cancelled in September 22 due to the ongoing conflict, as travelling anywhere was just too difficult for people, especially without the train lines, many of which that were out of action. It was actually a very rare time that the show was cancelled up to the point. It was nearly 100 years old at that stage. But since then, it has been cancelled during the Second World War and, of course, more recently with COVID. Now, the boys in St. Kieran's College in Kilkenny, however, were delighted with the conflict as they got an extra week or more of summer holidays. They didn't have to come back to school until the 12th of September. Now, on a much more sadder note, the youngest Kilkenny fatality of the Civil War occurred on the 30th of September 1922. William Purcell, who was just 16 years old and from Kellymount, Paulstown, had enlisted in the Free State Army a few months earlier. He was accidentally shot in the stomach the previous day by one of his comrades in Templemore Barracks in County Tipperary. He survived for a number of hours after the shooting, but subsequently passed away as the bullets had severed a main artery. His grieving mother, Annie Purcell, ran a public house and grocery in Paulstown. Only 4 years previously, in November 1918, she'd lost her husband, also called William. He was just 37 years old when he died, having succumbed to the great flu epidemic of that year. Of course, this was an era before vaccines or even paracetamol, so flu killed a lot of people during that epidemic. This left Annie to provide for their 7 children, the youngest being just 2 years old at the time. The Free State Army reported William's age as being 18 years old when he died, which is likely the age he gave on enlistment. There was no checks when enlisting, and it was a common occurrence for young people to give an older age to try and get into the well-paid soldiering job. If they looked a bit older than their years, it usually helped as well. Annie received just £65 in compensation from the government for the loss of her son. She had originally been offered just £40, as a publican was considered slightly better off than the average, but this was increased to £65 after she appealed to W.T. Cosgrave, the local TD and the chairman of the provisional government by then. Now, that's still only around €5,000 in today's money, but to even get that money took years of paperwork. Annie wrote to the compensation board in 1924 stating, quote, "Now I hope this will be my last letter that I will have to write. It's only God that knows what I have suffered for the last 2 years and 2 months for the loss of my poor boy. So I'll ask you, for God's sake, to settle it once and for all." End quote. Either way, it was not a large amount of money and would not go far in providing for a family of 6. Now, it was not just the Free State Army who were having bad luck with friendly fire incidents, so-called. Just a month before, a small column of 5 anti-treaty IRA were resting on a haystack at the farm of the Maguire family of Crut Clock near Castlecomer. The 5 present were Frank Byrne, Thomas Maguire, John Brophy, Thomas Brennan and John Keenan. They had been carrying out raids for arms in the area earlier that day. The men had been part of the Free State Forces stationed in Castlecomer Barracks up to the 28th of June, at which point they decided to desert to the anti-treaty side, taking their guns with them. Now, while in the process of cleaning his revolver in Maguire's field, one of the anti-treaty men accidentally discharged his weapon, hitting Frank Byrne. A witness to the tragedy, Thomas Mike Brennan, described what happened. Quote, "One of the company was repairing a revolver by turning some screws with a knife. Suddenly, a shot went off and Frank, who was sitting directly opposite him, fell, shot about the heart area. He was part of the column billeted at Tom Maguire's Crut Castlecomer, under whose orders he was at the time of the accident." End quote. Byrne passed away almost immediately. He was 21 years old and originally from Monteen Gretty Yard, about 7 kilometres from where he met his end. He was previously employed as a miner up until February 1922 when one of the coal mines closed down. Now, friendly fire incidents were all too common during the Civil War, as many of these young men taking part on both sides were undertrained, especially in the Free States Army. Now, during September and October 1922, lawlessness continued to escalate. Some of the incidents were as a result of the anti-treaty IRA robberies, as they needed supplies and money to continue the fight. For instance, gallons of petrol were stolen by the anti-treaty from the home of Major McCalmont in Thomastown, now of course Mount Julius Hotel his house is. They needed his fuel for their lorries, which they had commandeered, and also to burn down strategic buildings. The anti-treaty forces also raided some of the larger Stacey homes in the county. Sheestown House near Benedict Bridge was raided while the family were out attending mass. In Muckalee, the local creamery was raided by the anti-treaty men in their quest to find new pairs of boots. Good footwear was a valuable commodity, as you can imagine, considering the huge distances people travelled on foot. Now, the anti-treaty IRA were also attempting to discommode the Free State Army by destroying public infrastructure. This usually meant attacks on the railway, the roadways and the bridges. Now, in Goran, there was an attempt made by the anti-treaty to burn down the grandstand at Goran Park Racecourse. Luckily for the racetrack owners, the fire never took hold. The attempted arson of Goran Park Grandstand was on the night of the 27th of September 1922, the same night McCalmont's petrol was stolen in Thomastown. It is therefore most likely that this petrol was used in the attempt to burn the grandstand. These destructive activities caused severe annoyance to the Free States authorities, while also exposing them to large compensation claims, which was probably the reason for it happening in the first place. Now, it should be said that the attacks on the country's infrastructure irked ordinary members of the public just as much as it irritated the government. Most of the post office larcenies in the county were carried out by the anti-treaty IRA. The most opportune time to raid a post office was just after the postmaster or postmistress has cashed the checks to pay the old age pension. As this money came from the public exchequer, the IRA considered its actions as taking money from the enemy, i.e. the provisional government. During September and October, the post offices in Octofer, Tullerone, Freshford, Inistigue, Mullinavat, Fidown and Piltown, to name just a few, were robbed, with various quantities of cash and stamps taken. Labour strife also still occurred during the Civil War. In Goran, disgruntled farm labourers destroyed all the corn belonging to one local farmer whom they were having a dispute with. Overpay, of course. Four men were later arrested by the Free State forces for the malicious damage of crops, including the secretary of the Gores Bridge branch of the ITGWU. Some astute business owners were using the turmoil for their own advantage, as is always the case in any time of conflict or war. Keane's drugstore in Kilkenny City advertised the miraculous healing powers of one specific cream, something they recommended everyone should carry in case they accidentally found themselves in the middle of an ambush. The advert used some mild scare tactics to promote the purported antiseptic cream, and here's a quote from the ad, quote, "An ambush in High Street might cause many casualties, wounds, cuts, broken knees, etc. All would be safe if Curacos, the great healing ointment, was applied," end quote. Now, no amount of ointment could save the lives of Free State soldiers Thomas Brownrigg from Dunamagan and Patrick Hayes from Kilkenny City, who were both fatally wounded in an ambush in Tipperary in the early hours of Monday the 2nd of October 1922. Brownrigg and Hayes were in a Crossley Tender motor lorry along with 10 other comrades and were proceeding from Clonmel to Care in the County Tipperary. About 4 kilometres beyond Woodruff in the townland of Knockah, the Free State group were ambushed by an anti-treaty IRA column under the command of Paddy Dalton. Fire opened from a number of directions and the Free State soldiers attempted to speed through the ambush position, at which point the driver was shot. The vehicle came to a halt in the middle of ferocious firing. The Free State troops were quickly ordered to dismount from the lorry by their commander, Captain Joseph Welsh, and return fire. Welsh, however, was shot dead just as he alighted himself. He was actually from Monaghan and had been a teacher in Callan some years previously. The Free State men then rolled along the ground underneath a fence for protection, but during this manoeuvre, Brownrigg and Hayes were shot. There was a brief exchange of fire between the two sides, but the Free State soldiers quickly surrendered. Their ammunition and rifles were seized by the anti-treaty men, along with a pair of new boots. The uninjured soldiers were then given permission to return to Clonmel with the body of their deceased captain. The two badly injured Kilkenny privates and the driver Patrick Lawler, also from Kilkenny, who actually survived his injuries, luckily enough. The 24-year-old Thomas Brownrigg from Danganmore in Dunamagan was mortally wounded, having been shot in the head. He died in St. Joseph's Hospital, Clonmel, some days later, and his body was transferred to Winegap for his funeral. He had been a farm labourer before joining the Free State Army and was a cousin of the Bishop of Ossory. He had seven siblings and lived with his parents in Dunamagan. His mother, Kate Brownrigg, received the maximum allowed compensation of £100 for the death of her son. Thomas's father, Michael, was a farm labourer but also had been invalided for over a year prior to his son's death and was unable to work. The other fatality, Patrick Hayes from Barrack Street in Kilkenny City, also died in St. Joseph's Hospital a little bit later on the 12th of October 1922 as a result of the injuries he received in the ambush. He had been shot in the right lung, with the wound later becoming gangrenous. His remains were brought back to Kilkenny City the following day, where his funeral, with full military honours, took place. He had also been employed as a farm labourer prior to enlisting in the Free State Army. He had three sisters and was the only son of Mary Hayes. Sadly, Mary's husband, James, had died in the Boer War in South Africa even prior to Patrick being born, leaving her a widow at the age of 27 with five young children. Another daughter, that's Bridget, had died in 1901, aged one. Mary was compelled to return to live with her parents, the Hickeys of Magdalen Street, for some time to make do. Mary Hayes received £40 compensation for her son's death. She received a reduced amount compared to Brownrigg's mother because she was receiving a British Army pension of £1 a week on account of her husband's death over 20 years previously. Now, during October 1922, the hierarchy of the Catholic Church in Ireland released a pastoral letter which threatened those in the anti-treaty IRA with the denial of sacraments, that's effectively excommunication from the church, if they did not abandon the message which they now know are un-Catholic and immoral, end quote. The pastoral letter was signed by the Bishop of Ossory, Dr. Brownrigg, and also the coadjutor, Bishop of Ossory, James Downey, who was performing most of the administrative roles in the diocese in place of the frail Brownrigg. This partisan support for the Free State side by the Catholic hierarchy angered many within the anti-treaty IRA, who felt it was not their place. Now, the fighting continued and was unrelenting. On Wednesday the 18th of October at 9:30 a.m. a fierce gun rattle broke out in Kilmana between a party of Free State soldiers from Urlingford and an anti-treaty IRA ASU. Now, the Free State soldiers were passing through the area that morning when they were ambushed by a burst of machine gun fire from the side of the road. The Free State troops, under the command of Anthony Lawler, took cover and returned fire. Now, the battle raged for nearly 3 hours. The machine gunner for the anti-treaty men, Thomas O'Day, was killed in the initial stages of the attack. Eventually, the anti-treaty IRA withdrew. The Free State soldiers did manage to capture a section of 10 men of the IRA party, along with two rifles and a Lewis machine gun, so it was mildly successful for them. The deceased anti-treaty gunner, 24-year-old Thomas O'Day, was a member of the 3rd Tipperary Brigade and was a native of Robert Street, Mitchelstown, County Cork. Margaret Maher, who was an officer in the Callan Kilmana branch of Cumannamon, brought the remains of O'Day to Callan. With the help of Mary Tehan, she washed and laid him out before procuring a coffin. She then travelled with the remains to Mitchelstown to convey O'Day's body to his family and inform them of the circumstances of his death, which is no easy feat in that time during the Civil War. A Free State private was also killed in the same altercation. He was 22-year-old Patrick Quigley from Liss in Tullerone. Quigley was the youngest of 8 children of Timothy and the late Ellen Quigley, née Grace. He had been a farm labourer prior to joining the Free State Army. Soldiering, of course, offered him a much more secure role with higher income. He was killed only 7 kilometres from his homestead. Patrick Quigley was buried in his native Tullerone 2 days later in a funeral with full military honours. Quigley's 73-year-old father, Timothy, later received £50 in compensation for the loss of his son. The fact that Timothy was over 70 years old meant he received a state pension, which counted against him getting any additional compensation. But as I said, it's only a few thousand pounds anyway in euro in today's money. Now, in November 1922, nearly a year to the day of the Great Kilkenny jailbreak, that's when IRA prisoners burrowed their way to freedom, there was yet another cunning escape from Kilkenny jail. However, in stark contrast to the previous year, the escape was not comprehensively reported, as on this occasion it was the Free State authorities that were embarrassed by the anti-treaty IRA. So what happened was, just before midnight on the 15th of November 1922, 25 prisoners escaped from a 15-metre tunnel that led from one of the basement cells of A Wing to the uninhabited warders' cottages nearby, a plan that was very similar to the breakout scheme the year before. It was a number of hours before the Free State wardens in the prison realised the escape had taken place at all, and consequently, none of the 25 were recaptured. The prison authorities tried to play down the escape to the Free State GHQ, commenting that the men missing are not important, as the commandant and vice commandant and quartermaster are still here in the jail. Now, as a punishment, cigarettes were stopped for all the prisoners, much to their annoyance. For one of the escapees, it probably would have been better if he stayed in prison. Jim Hayes, brother of future Fianna Fáil politician Sean Hayes, was shot dead by Free State soldiers in County Tipperary just 2 days after his escape from Kilkenny. Other prisoners, such as Bob Kenny from Green's Bridge, found a less dramatic way of escaping from Kilkenny jail, and this happened before the main jailbreak in November 22. This story also demonstrates that the personal local complexities involved in the Civil War, as Free State wardens also may have known the people they were actually guarding, or even be friends with the prisoners in their charge. The acting governor of Kilkenny Jail filed the following report in November 22 regarding Kenny's escape, which also required him having to reprimand one of his own wardens or prison officers. Quote, Bob Kenny of Green's Bridge, Kilkenny, escaped at 6:30 Sunday evening, the 5th of November 22, by getting onto number 6 sentry box by means of a shed and jumped from there to the field outside. The sentry on duty at box number 6, O'Mara, says he did not see him going. O'Mara is from Kilkenny and knew Kenny very well. O'Mara, the prison officer, prison warden, is now under arrest. End quote. Now, generally, the prisoners inside Kilkenny Jail were well cared for, mostly because of the work of the local Cumann na mBan members. The women had a rota, taking it in turns to visit the anti-treaty internees and to boost morale. They also raised money to buy provisions and make hampers for the men in jail. In November 1922, Hannah Murphy, the Cumann na mBan Kilkenny Brigade leader, which of course was an anti-treaty organisation during the Civil War, described the activities in Kilkenny City in a report to her superiors in Dublin. Murphy stated there were just 9 active members of Cumann na mBan in Kilkenny City. She also draws attention to the sufferings of the families of the anti-treaty men who were in prison. Quote, as the city is military Free State HQ, the girls are constantly watched by Cumann na searchers and reports sent back to the Free State barracks. Cumann na searchers are of course the women on the pro-treaty Cumann na Saoirse. One girl is very good and entered the barracks and took a plan of us. She also has taken a plan of the jail and sent it on to Anti-Treaty Brigade GHQ. Literature is posted up on walls and gates about every week around Kilkenny, and stenciled mottos appear here and there on the walls. The literature is generally torn down, but the stencil and paintbrush work has not been interfered with yet. Dependents, that's dependents of the anti-treaty IRA and prisoner on the run, are being looked after. Not nearly all cases. Some cases are very bad. Families of young children left without support. End quote. Of course, the women of Cumann were far more likely to be in prison during the Civil War than had ever been the case during the War of Independence. Those on the Free State side understood their capabilities and their worth, having fought alongside the women of Cumann during the War of Independence. Hence, the Free State authorities were far more likely than the British ever were to arrest and intern Cumann women. Ellen Leahy, a member of Cumann attached to the 7th Battalion, had endured many raids by Crown forces during the War of Independence, as her brother, James Leahy, was 7th Battalion OC for most of it. She considered the Free State raids far worse. Quote, "We always refer to the Free State Army as the Tans, as they gave us far more trouble here. Some of them being callers to the House while they're in the movement in 1920 and 21 period. Then the split came and some turned their coats and persecuted those who had befriended them previously." End quote. Another woman, Mary Josephine or Mary Jo Commons, née Power, originally from Breyne or Piltown but married in Nine Mile House, was one of the principal Cumann officers in the Kilkenny Brigade. She was captain of her native Tipperary branch of Cumann, that's the 8th Battalion. She was present in the fields around Carrick on Shore during the fighting there in August 1922, rendering first aid to those who needed it. She was arrested by Free State soldiers later in the Civil War and imprisoned in Kilmainham Jail in Dublin. Now, many hunger strikes in prison took place during the Civil War by those supporting the anti-treaty side. Commons subsequently took part in two hunger strikes. She experienced ill health for the remainder of her life, including persistent rheumatic attacks, which she attributed to the conditions she endured in prison, as well as the hunger strikes. So it's just to point out that although people sometimes didn't die during hunger strikes, the effect on the body was enormous and lasted for the rest of their lives. So, as things moved into the winter period of 1922, it all looked very bleak, is the only way to describe it, with no end in sight. If anything, the tit-for-tat killings were escalating. With the Free State government now introducing a policy of executions, things looked like they could only get worse before they could ever get better. And I think that's where we'll leave it all there today. Just to thank you all once again for listening. Until next time.